You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
So, hey, we've been making this podcast for over 2.5 years.
What?
Yep, thanks to listeners like you. And from the gate, people have asked us for merchandise or additional content or even some hang time with me and Scott.
That's weird.
It is. But we think we have a solution for you.
Yep, we are excited to announce that we have a new Patreon page.
Yeah, and you know how people are patrons of the arts? Well, in this case, we're the arts.
Hmm. And by becoming a Patreon, you'll get bonus content, access to outtakes that the general public will never see, extremely cool merch, and depending on what tier you get on, a monthly hang time with Laura and I.
Yep, and it all starts at just $5 a month.
That's nothing.
Right? Not per day, not per week. It's only $5 per month.
And you're guaranteed merchandise.
Yeah, oh, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So click the link in the show notes to read about the different tiers and see what great stuff you can get. Become a podcast patron. Join our Patreon today at www.patreon.com/theonlyoneintheroom.
Hi, my name is Kelly Wallace, and I'm the only 8-year-old who testified against her paternal grandfather in court. I saw a video in my second grade classroom, and it was a child sexual abuse awareness video. And it was during that video that it was like a light bulb went off in my head. And I knew in that moment that what was happening between my grandfather and I was not normal. And up until that point, I thought what was happening was normal. I thought that this is just what happens between daughters and grandfathers.
Picture this. You're a child, only 8 years old. And because the court won't allow your parents in with you, you enter a courtroom alone to testify against the grandfather who molested you. Kelly Wallace, writer, memoirist, and co-host of the Zoom reading series, Voices of Survivors, remembers seeing the bailiff with his gun and thinking, "That's the man that will take my grandfather away." But what would you do if your perpetrator was acquitted and even your own father didn't believe you? Would you spend the rest of your life hating and resenting men? Or would you create a platform to give people a space to voice their own stories of survival? Hi, I'm Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is The Only One in the Room. This podcast is for anyone who has ever felt alone in a room full of people, which is to say that this podcast is for everyone. Kelly Wallace, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good to see you, good to hear you. Question for you before we start the interview. I know a lot of people, first thing what they do when they wake up is they reach for their iPhones. Some people, it's meditation. Some people, it's a race to the restroom. What's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning?
I reach for my phone and I check Facebook and my email.
Ah, yeah. You're honest.
Me too, Kelly.
Honest to a fault.
You're honest. I love it. Yes. Thank you for that honesty. We always appreciate it.
I am Laura Cathcart Robbins, and this is the only one in the room, but I am never the only one in this room because, as usual, my boyfriend, producer, and co-host, Scott Slaughter, who I call Hun, is here as well.
Hi, honey.
Hey, Hun. So today we are talking to Kelly Wallace.
All right.
I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. She's an adult survivor of childhood sexual abuse. She testified against her paternal grandfather at age 8 years old back in the days before closed captioning TV in 1985. Mm-hmm. She's at work at a memoir about her experience, and she's been published in The Manifestation and On Loan from the Cosmos. A frequent podcast guest, she enjoys sharing her story of recovering from sexual trauma as well as struggles with alcoholism and eating disorder and financial chaos across a wide variety of platforms. She hosts Voices of Survivors, a monthly Zoom reading series with Addy Tsai, is that how you say it?
Yes.
A Houston-based writer that highlights the voices of survivors of sexual trauma from a variety of backgrounds, which is so cool. Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome
to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. I was really intrigued by your story when I saw your letter to us, but even more intrigued when you and I got to speak on the phone and you were telling it to me. So I'm happy to be able to have you share what happened with you and what's happened since in your own words with our listeners. Before we start, how do you identify, Kelly?
She, her.
Okay. We're going to jump right in. You were 8 years old when this happened, like we just said. Can you tell me in whatever way you feel comfortable what happened, the acts that brought you to court to testify against your father's father?
My parents were in the middle of a messy divorce when I was about 6 into age 7. And my dad was taking my sister and I to his grandparents' house for visitation, where he was living in Eastern Oregon at the time. And the sexual abuse was happening during those visits. So I don't have an exact memory of when they started. The way that trauma impacts the brain in these types of events is that the events all get rolled into one incident. So it's like I can play the movie of what happened in my head. And so from those visits, I do know based on, you know, I have really good court records. Based on records, I know that it kind of ramped up in the summer of 1984 and then in the fall of 1984 as well during a couple visits. After the very last visit, which took place around Thanksgiving, I saw a video in my second grade classroom, and it was a child sexual abuse awareness video. And it was during that video that it was like a light bulb went off in my head. And I knew in that moment that what was happening between my grandfather and I was not normal. And up until that point, I thought what was happening was normal. I thought that this is just what happens between daughters and grandfathers. And so I went into the kitchen. It took me about 11 to 12 days to process that information and to tell my mom what happened. And so my mom was a very strong ally, and she believed me from the very get-go. And so I told her what happened, and she immediately called the police, and a whole bunch of actions started taking place.
So this was happening in private, in secret?
Yes.
So there were no witnesses to what he was doing?
There were no witnesses. My dad and I had an aunt that was about 7 years older than I was. They were down in the basement. They kind of knew, they must have known what was happening. There were several other people, two other women that actually came forward after a police report was filed. And it was determined that these two other women were also molested or touched by my grandfather, but there was no follow-up.
Okay. My experience is that these types of predators are usually very charming outwardly, which kind of leaves them above suspicion in a way, because they're seen as one type of person, but behind closed doors. You know, I don't know what type of like grooming occurred or any of that with you, but then there's another persona that comes out. Was that your experience?
My persona is that I was groomed. The incident started out tame and then ramped up somewhat. And my grandfather was a chaperone for Future Farmers of America events for 4-H. Mm. So he was kind of looked at in the community as this upstanding member. He was a cattle rancher, but he was a drunk. He was drinking around the clock. He could not eat solid foods. He was eating Carnation instant breakfast and ice cream.
Because of the drinking?
Yes.
Yeah. It does a lot of damage to the stomach and the esophagus. And
yeah.
Wow. So he was really impaired by his drinking.
Super impaired, driving with my sister and I and my aunt around these old country roads. Impaired, he often had a Rainier beer between his legs while he was driving.
What a memory for I can see that. I can see that.
Yes.
Like I could see it in a movie almost.
Yes.
Your dad, you mentioned him. Your dad was a deputy district attorney. Is that right?
Yes.
It was his father. We already established that, who had molested you.
Yes.
Did you feel like your dad was put in a position where he had to choose a side? And what did he do, if so?
That's a really good question. I've never thought about it that way before. He probably was put in that position where he had to choose. And he unfortunately chose to side with my grandfather, which this was, 30 years before the Me Too movement. And it was just a very different culture back in those days where women and children were not believed. I mean, they're still not really believed in great numbers today, but it was even worse back then. So the voices of people like myself were often silenced. And so my dad was able to kind of rally the troops, all my family members, and get them to come to his side. And my grandfather was also in a family business with two other members of the family who were neighbors, essentially. There was a lot riding on keeping the secrets
free. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, free of the taint of it, free literally, so that he wasn't imprisoned. Mm-hmm. You became a problem then.
Oh, I was a huge problem. I ripped the Band-Aid off.
Yeah. Now, you said your mother believed you.
Yes.
And she believed you immediately from the beginning. She called the authorities. Is that right?
Yeah, she believed me from the very beginning because she was concerned because I was exhibiting some very concerning behaviors, talking about wanting to die before I was 9. She knew something was wrong, but she didn't know what was wrong. And so when I disclosed to her, when I told her what was happening, she leapt into action and called the police, and a police report was filed. It was around Christmas time. I was interviewed by detectives, police officers, and in the new year, I was put into individual therapy, and I was put into group therapy with other little girls like myself who were being molested by close family members.
Wow.
I mean, it happened so fast, and, I had a supportive mother, and I had the support of a therapist who believed me and thought that my story had validity. I had a very good recall of events because the last incident had happened so close to when I disclosed. So a lot of times what happens is people that are molested will bury the thoughts, and it's often not until years later that the thoughts arise.
I am just curious because I think it's just so important, and I'm so struck by the fact that your mom saw that you weren't yourself and took action. Is there anything that you might say to a parent out there who maybe doesn't know what to look for with their kid? That's something we should get checked out, or maybe there's a question they should ask?
Yeah, there's so many things to really look out for if your child is withdrawn, just suddenly is very fearful of certain adults being around them. That's another red flag. I think the bigger question is really talking to your children about what is appropriate touch with. I think that we do a much better job of that nowadays, but really starting young and saying, your private parts are your private parts and no one should touch them unless it's like mommy or daddy and you're having an issue in the bathroom. I mean, it's like things like that, or just instilling really strong boundaries with children at a very young age about speaking up.
Yeah. I remember my kids' pediatrician, they're born a year apart, my boys. And when they were babies, she would be examining them and she's narrating the whole time. And when she would remove the underwear or even the diaper, you know, when they were little, she would say out loud, "No one ever touches this part of you without mommy and daddy being present."
Exactly.
They couldn't understand what she was saying.
Of course.
But it was, she said it every single time, mm-hmm. every, you know, physical. This was very important for them to know.
Yeah.
They just took it as fact after that. It was ingrained. Thank you for that. I wanted to find out about the trial itself, if you don't mind talking about that, what it was like to come in and then did you sit in like the witness box? Were you examined by the attorneys? Like how did that work?
It's really important to know that the trial was continued. It was set originally in April, so like 5 months after I had disclosed. Then it was postponed to July and it was postponed again until December. So a full year had passed in between the time that I had disclosed and in between when the trial took place in an attempt to get me to back down.
It was strategic.
It was totally strategic. And during that time, my dad was coming to my school and he was trying to talk to teachers. He was trying to talk to the school counselor, the principal, anyone that would listen. And he was trying to do some witness intimidation in not so many words.
Wow.
That caused my mother to pull me out of school. She actually put me into a very, very small private school. And my dad tried to show up there and the director of the school turned him away. So there was a lot going on in between the time that I disclosed and when the actual trial took place. So the day that it was a 3-day trial. So when the trial took place, it was December 1985. And when I walked into the courtroom, I had a CASA, I had a court appointed special advocate with me. And I think her name was Cindy. And so she was the only person who, my mom was not allowed to be in the courtroom with me. She was called as a witness. And that was also an attempt to separate.
Wait, I'm sorry. You're 8 and she's not allowed to be in the courtroom with you? What's the reasoning for that? That's terrible.
They were trying to separate my mother and I because she was my ally. It was, again, it was another attempt.
Oh, wow.
To get me to trip up and slip up. And they called her as a witness and she answered 5 very simple questions. What's your name? Where do you live? What do you do for work? And then they dismissed her. So when I walked into the courtroom, the rows were stacked with my paternal family. And my grandfather was sitting at the desk with his 2 attorneys. He always wore a cowboy hat. And so the cowboy hat was sitting on the corner of the desk where he was sitting. So I would have to walk past him to get to the witness stand. So when I was on the witness stand, I testified for about 1 hour and 45 minutes. During that time, I was pretty catatonic and not able to hold it together. So I had to take anywhere from like 10 to 15 breaks to go to the bathroom with my CASA volunteer and my mom, who was waiting outside the door, and collect myself. And so the questions were incredibly invasive. And another thing that's also important to know, so not only was my dad coming to my school, there was a little window in the courtroom door, and he was looking at me during the entire proceeding.
Through the window?
Through the window.
Wow.
He was not allowed to be in there because he had also testified on my grandfather's behalf. That was what I recall. I recall looking at the clock on the wall. Mm-hmm. I had a safety pin. I had a kilt that I was wearing. And I had this giant safety pin that I was touching frequently while I was being asked questions. And so there was a bailiff and the bailiff had a gun. And when I saw the bailiff with a gun, I thought, that's the man that's going to take my grandpa away. And so it was a 3-day trial. It was a jury trial. And he was found not guilty based on my testimony not being strong enough. And we didn't know at the time that my dad may have also been potentially helping him develop questions for my grandfather's team.
Like questions designed to rattle you or to make you look less credible?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and some of the questions that the defense asked me were just kind of like mind-boggling. Like, do you think this video that you watched may have caused you to make this up? That was kind of their defense.
Right.
And so, yeah, like I said, it was just a very, very different time. And that was what happened. But, you know, if these 2 other women had come forward and testified, there may have been others.
Right. So there were two other victims?
Yes.
What happened with them? How did you find out about them, and why didn't they testify?
So 8 months after this criminal trial, my grandfather's criminal trial, he filed a civil suit against the state of Oregon for $1 million. And he sued the detectives, my therapist, and we had a couple caseworkers who were working on my behalf as well. And so they sued them, stating that the police had not done a thorough investigation, that my therapist had not, you know, disclosed enough information from her therapy notes, things of that nature. So it was during that my mom was able to get her hands on the entire court transcript. And mm-hmm. It was during that, while she was reading through that information, she was able to find out that these other women had come forward, but they clammed up.
They were intimidated, probably.
Yeah.
Wow. Were they also young?
One of the women said that she was 12 or 13 when my grandfather either touched her on the shoulder or touched her on the knee and, quote, looked at her the way a man looks at a woman. These two women had been on the FFA trips with him that he was chaperoning. And then 20 years later, so in 2008, I had a cousin come find me on MySpace, a paternal cousin, and she said that he had molested her as well. And we compared notes, and she, unfortunately, she's just not a safe person to really have in my life because of what happened to her. She has some mental health issues.
Wow. We're going to take just a quick break to tell you about a cool new product that Scott and I discovered. And we'll get back to our guest's amazing Only One story in just a minute.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
So he's acquitted. There's this civil suit going on. I'm assuming you are now, as you had been, solely in the care of your mom, right?
Yes.
You do not have a relationship after that with your father or your grandfather, correct?
I did not see my grandfather ever again, except a brief blip when I was 17. I got so spooked by that, that my dad, basically, my dad and my stepmom, I was on a very brief visit with them. He drove by the house. He was going to drop my grandmother off. I saw his cowboy hat, freaked out. And thankfully, they arranged for my grandmother to be dropped off at like a Safeway parking lot down the street. So I did not have to interact with him. But my dad was in and out of my life. But, you know, the thing that's been the most difficult for me is he just has chose to not believe me this entire time, and it's splintered our relationship.
I can't imagine. The fact that this is your daughter who's hurt and is brave enough to come forward and tell these very uncomfortable things to a room full of adults without any allies or supports in the room with her, it's just unfathomable to me that he wouldn't be there with you if he could. You know what I mean? I don't understand that. But he did fight for custody of you, did he not? Is that right?
Yes, he fought for custody of my sister and I.
Your sister's younger?
My sister is 4 years younger than I am, yes.
Okay.
So there was the criminal trial in 1985, a civil trial in 1986, and then a custody trial in 1987, which he lost. And yeah, he tried to paint my mother as unfit, but he lost that trial as well.
Mm. And the judge in that case was very, he was aligned with your mom,
yes,
right?
He was aligned
with my mom. He saw her and he saw the efforts that she was putting forth and he was supportive.
Yes, he was very supportive.
That's wonderful. So now I kind of want to move to you maybe in your teenage years, having left these three trials behind, the initial trial, the criminal trial, the civil trial, and then the custody trial, which is more trials than I've ever been in for anything. I've never been in any trials, actually. So you've, you know, by the time you were, what, 10 years old, you've been through three. What was it like for you then being a teenager? Did you have any impact from the trauma that you suffered?
The thing that, you know, carried over was anxiety. And I've always been very quiet. And in high school, I was very quiet. And I also had a learning disability that made it challenging for me to take standardized testing. So I didn't have the realization back then to really know. I wasn't like failing out, but I wasn't like an A plus student. I was like a C plus student. And I just didn't realize at that time that I had trauma upon trauma upon trauma that was a barrier to me in getting a good education. And being very quiet in a high school that was very, very pro football, very pro cheerleader. And I was a giant nerd. And I was on the high school newspaper. And I sought out, thankfully, you know, with my dad's income, I was able to seek out and find a women's college in upstate New York. And through a combination of grants and financial aid and student loans, I was able to extract myself from small town Oregon to small town upstate New York. But at least in upstate New York, I was around other women who were, the college that I went to was like 350 people. It was very tiny. So
wow.
Yeah. My education was really good. And I had to talk in class. It was just a huge part of my grade. I had to write these long term papers. And I wasn't like a great student there either, but at least I had more challenge and there was more emphasis on being a leader out in the world. And so I came away from my college. I kind of floundered a little bit because I developed an eating disorder and I started drinking heavily in college. But once I graduated and kind of got a little bit of sobriety under my feet, I really started excelling. I started this woman in New York City started this networking group. And I started a chapter here in Portland, and it grew to be the second largest in the United States. And after that, I started my own consulting business, contracting with the state of Oregon to help people with disabilities find jobs. So I still continue to do that to this day.
I just want to go back a little bit. I'm curious because for me, my teenage, like my high school grades, all of that, like I dropped out of school in 10th grade. I didn't finish, but it was all about my social life. It was about dating. It was about, you know, hanging out with folks. It was about, I didn't go to college, but I still kind of had a college social life. I still kind of did all the things people do in college, even though I didn't go.
Right.
And so that's kind of more what I was looking for was like, what were you like socially during those years?
So when I was, I want to say like freshman and into my sophomore year, I was so quiet that I just did not have any friends. I had a friend that I knew when I was from age six. And so I would hang out with her a little bit. But it wasn't really until I was a sophomore, like towards the end of my sophomore year, where I was like, dudes are noticing me. Like something like switched. Yeah. And I was like, I think I kind of thought of myself as like not very attractive. And then I was like, wow, I must have something going on because guys in my high school are starting to notice me. And then I didn't have like a lot of boyfriends. I went to this writing workshop when I was 16 in Western Massachusetts. And I had a boyfriend there that I had he was in my poetry workshop with me.
Sounds like a nice guy.
He was a nice guy. He was from Long Island. His dad worked for ABC News. And I was like, wow, this is kind of cool, you know, but I, you know, I lost touch with him because it was, you know, 1993 and the days before MySpace and Friendster and everything like that. So I was on the newspaper my sophomore year, I think. And so I kind of started getting some friends there when I was on the newspaper. So I had more of a social life. Like I was hanging out with people my own age, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very small town, just like my friends and I would drive around. We didn't drink. We were very like innocent. We didn't smoke.
You didn't start drinking until college?
No. I mean, I took my very first drink when I was 16, when I was babysitting. The people that I was babysitting for had a box of Franzia in the refrigerator. And I thought, I should take a drink of Franzia and just kind of see.
Wait, what's Franzia?
It's like drunk in a box. It's like the liquor in it. It's like wine in a box. Oh,
okay, like boxed wine. Yeah, okay.
So I was like, I should have a drink of that while I'm babysitting. I mean, that was like the first clue that I didn't have a healthy relationship with alcohol. But it wasn't until I was in college that my drinking really like started to escalate.
Was there a part of you when you were kind of having this picturesque teenage life where you're riding around in cars and you guys are, you know, was there a part of you that was like, oh, good, what happened to me when I was eight hasn't impacted me to the point where I can't socialize, where I can't not date? Like, was there a part of you that was relieved? You didn't talk much about dating, but do you feel like it did? I guess I should start there. Do you feel like it impacted your ability to be touched, to touch, to be intimate?
I think because, like I said, from a very early age, I was plunged into therapy. And I think therapy, God, I love therapy. I mean, it saved me. It really saved me. And so having intimate relationships was not necessarily a problem for me. Today, actually, I have a mild dissociative disorder. So sometimes, like if I am intimate with someone, I do have a little bit of a moment where the trauma can take over my body and it can feel like someone is, like I can feel like myself, like I'm watching myself from above. And sure, I have to like take a deep breath and get back into my body and collect myself.
That happens to me all the time. Doing lots of stuff, not just being intimate.
Exactly.
And it is work. It's a conscious, like, get back in there.
Exactly.
This is enjoyable. Yeah. Go enjoy it.
Exactly.
Don't stay out here. That's great. That's a great advertisement for therapy. Yeah. You know, I've been wanting to actually write about this. I think we're a society that maybe 20, 25 years ago, if you had a therapist, you were like, so LA or so, you know, Hollywood or whatever. And now it feels like everybody and their kids have therapists.
Yeah.
And it's very like, you don't have a therapist.
Exactly.
Like, what's wrong with you that you're not in therapy? One of our sponsors is BetterHelp. Have you heard of them?
Yes.
They're online. They're really great. So if you're listening to this, you probably have listened to one of their ads. But I was just using it as an example of how accessible therapy is. Now, you don't even have to leave your house for BetterHelp. You just like go online. It's a remote therapy session. You don't have waiting rooms. They match you with people if it's not the right match, you know, but they make it so easy. And I love the idea that your mom had the foresight or the willingness, even if it wasn't her idea, to get you in therapy early on when this trauma occurred. That's really important.
It's super important. And the really cool thing is that my therapist from childhood, her name is Pam Crow, she's actually my therapist again now. So
wow.
I had a long-term therapist that I worked with for about 10 years in my 30s and into my early 40s, and she retired. And then my therapist that retired said, well, you should see if Pam is available. Maybe you could work with her again. And so I reached out to her. Yeah. I actually have not seen her. I mean, all of our sessions are video sessions, but it's really cool to work with her again, especially because she knows my story and she testified at my grandfather's trial. So she knows.
Wow. That's a huge full
circle. It's a huge full circle.
That's very unexpected. Yeah. I'm so pleased that you guys were able to make that happen.
Me too.
Tell me about these Zoom calls with Addie Tsai.
Several years ago, I have never actually met Addie Tsai. She's a Houston-based writer, and she was a victim of this writer named Nick Flynn, who basically, he's a seasoned writer. He's a Houston-based memoir writer. Several of his books have been turned into movies. But he was going around and essentially targeting a lot of BIPOC women in their 20s. When he was in his 40s. And so Addie was a victim of him. So we connected on either the Facebook or Twitter, and we started having conversations about, you know, starting a reading series. And, you know, I'm writing this memoir about my experience of testifying. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great to have something that would complement that? And so in May, we started finding writers who are victims of sexual assault and featuring their voices on this Zoom series that meets once a month. We have anywhere from 3 to 7 writers read from varying backgrounds and experience levels. And it's just been a really good place to focus those voices that are often not heard. Somewhat organically, we, you know, after the readings, we do a Q&A. And so someone tosses out a question and we talk about, you know, hey, what's it like to write about trauma? Or how do you get through writing about those difficult experiences? And so it's been great to just hear other people's stories and through the Q&A really get like a collective kind of going.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I know that the link to sign up for those or to witness those is in your website, because I just had to click past it to grab your bio. I know. So I know it's there. It's up there right now. Tell people where they can find you.
You can find me on kellywallace.org, which is my website. My Instagram is Kelly the Writer.
As it should be.
My Twitter handle is Kelly the Writer 1, with the number 1 at the very end, not spelled out. And you can find information about my reading series on my website.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, gosh, Kelly, thank you so much. Thank you for this. I learned even more about you than I did from our conversation before. And I'm so glad you took your time to explore and explain these really tender, vulnerable pieces of your life and share them with us. Thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you for giving me the platform to do this. I'm super excited.
Yeah. We'll have to touch base again when your memoir comes out.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for listening. The Only One in the Room is produced by the creative genius that is Scott Slaughter, and edited by the uber-talented polymath Christina Barcy and her team at Avant House Productions. Hey, you're still listening? Good. Please subscribe right now while you're thinking about it, quick, before you forget. And be sure to like and leave us a review of the show. Want to connect with some other Only One listeners? Be sure to join our private Only One in the Room Facebook group, or check out Patreon on our website for exclusive content that you won't find anywhere else. And do you have an Only One in the Room story that you'd like to share? Please send it to theonlyonepod@gmail.com.
Dear stranger, I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.